We are in Romans 11, verses 9 and 10. We spent most of our time last time considering the fact that Paul used David's words to establish his thesis that the elect obtained it and the rest were hardened. That was his issue in verse 7 at the end. That was the conclusion we were supposed to draw. And then he gives his biblical support in verses 8, 9, and 10. But in our study at that time, I raised the issue of David's words simply because David is well known for basically two big deals. One is his conflict with Goliath, and the other is his adultery with Bathsheba. And you read his words in verses 9 and 10, and you wonder, how does he have this attitude toward the wicked, whose behavior is not that much different from his in at least that regard, that one regard or one instance? And so that's where our study went. Involved in the issue of the hardening thing that we looked at in verse 7 is not the timing of the hardening. I believe that the statement, those who were chosen obtained it and the rest were hardened, not as a statement about they were hardened at that time, but as a statement of their condition. The elect received it and the rest were of the condition of the hardened, and as a consequence, they didn't receive it, because this issue of being hardened is a real issue. And we saw that the real issue in the issue of hardening is, as I said, not the timing, because the issue is, it's a matter of, it stands written, verse 8, as it stands written. That's a perfect tense. It means this is a reality that had its beginning at some point, and it's coming. Continuing, in this case, it's the writing of David, but nonetheless, he's writing about a condition that stands as a real issue. He says in verse 8 at the end of the verse, down to this very day, so that it was in place back when David said these things, and it's still in place 1,000 years later. And then in verse 9, it says, and David is saying, that verb is present tense, which means that his words are to be taken as a contemporary statement. He's still saying this. And that indicates that it's a condition that's continuing. And then he even has in verse 10 at the end, bend their backs, that word translated forever literally means unto all. And the supplied word is time, in all time. Or through all time. It's actually not in, it's through. Through all time. He wants their backs to be bent over through all time. So what we get from the statements in verses 8, 9, and 10 is this picture that this hardness thing is something that settled in at some point and is continuing all the way through human history. And I argued last time that the point was at the, well, not last time, the time before, was at the fall in Genesis 3, where God imposed a law upon Adam. He said, in the day you eat thereof, you shall surely die. He ate, he died. And the darkness was imposed, and the darkness showed up immediately with Cain killing his brother. And then it showed up in the progress through Genesis 6, where you come to this great wickedness that brings about the flood, where God kills everybody on the planet except for Noah and his family. So the whole issue of hardness is well established way back from the garden. But it's also demonstrated throughout Israel's history, because God chose Abraham, and the issue of hardness was present in Abraham's experience and choices to some degree, because he made his mistakes. And then Isaac comes on the scene, and he's not quite the man of God that his father was. And then Jacob comes on the scene, and he's not even close. And he has 12 sons from 4 wives, or 4 women, and that constitutes the nation. And the nation is a rebellious, obstinate, stiff-necked bunch of people. So Moses even says, look, God didn't choose you because you were particularly good. He chose you in spite of the fact that you're an obstinate, stiff-necked people. And then in Deuteronomy, Moses even said, even to this day, God has not given you a heart to understand, or eyes to see, or ears to hear. So hardness has been the problem. And Israel's behavior and demeanor and attitudes developed over time to prove that the hardness was in place, because when Jesus came, they murdered him, which is the ultimate end of hardness. So the whole point here is that the hardness was brought into creation by God's just reaction to the sin of Adam. Hardness was imposed because of God's reaction to the sin, a reaction that it was judicial. And in this reality, there are recognizably different degrees of hardness, because we have the records in Mark 6 and 8 about disciples who believe in Jesus, who are disciples of Jesus, who are following him around and learning and all that. But they evidence the presence of hardness. They have a hard heart because they can't connect feeding the 5,000 with walking on water or still in the storm. And later, after the feeding of the 4,000, they can't connect the fact that Jesus is talking about the leaven of the Pharisees and of Herod in relation to leaven, which is in the loaves of bread. And they are all puzzled. And he says, "You still have a hardened heart?" So, conversion, faith, commitment, life through God's provision does not erase the problem. It mitigates it to some degree, but doesn't erase it. And then you have these people who, at the end of chapter 10, God is holding out his hands all day long, and they are unpersuaded, willfully so, and they're argumentative. He calls it, it's translated obstinate, but it basically means they want to argue about everything. And so the whole point here is that in chapter 11, Paul's line of argument in chapter 11 is that it takes a grace-based divine decision to interfere with the progression of hardness in the lives of individuals in order for those individuals to escape that initial divine justice reaction to the sin. When hardness was imposed by the judicial decree of death for sin, everybody was going to go to this death reality unless God interfered. I think the most potent point of Mark 6 and 8, where the disciples are still hardened in certain core issues, is evidence of the magnitude of the problem. So that because hardness is a serious problem, if God does not intervene, then it's hopeless. And Paul's argument is in 11:6 that it's entirely grace-based, and that means two inevitable things. First, it means that law, as a divine justice-driven decision, must be first satisfied, and then second, set aside, or there'll be no flesh saved. If God doesn't satisfy the just demands against sin and set that law aside, nobody will survive. Hardness will kill them all, because the commitment to sin is to death. So that's the first thing that a grace-based process means. It means God has removed the justice demand issue and then replaced it with a non-demanding grace-based thing, where grace is extended regardless of merit, demerit, or whatever. I was thinking earlier about the fact that the Bible says God resists the proud and gives grace to the humble. But he also gives grace to the proud, or Saul would have never been converted. I mean, you know. So, if you want grace, you can get it by humbling yourself. But even if you don't humble yourself, you may get some grace. The cautionary thing is you don't want to play with this, because God does kind of get sometimes irritated with people who play on grace, and then their reaction is a little bit more severe than would have otherwise been. But I said there were two things that grace-based means. The second thing is that grace inevitably results in what Paul called the elect. Since the grace of God obviously means that God has to make individual decisions about those that he's going to interfere with in terms of their being destroyed by their hardness. He's got to decide whether he's going to involve himself or not. And that's his decision. Even in the ministry of Jesus, where he went around preaching and healing and doing all these miraculous things. There were some times when he would heal everybody that was brought to him. But I don't know if he ever went out of his way to heal anybody. And as a consequence, if you didn't come to him, you probably didn't get the healing that was available to. But the whole point there is, he didn't heal everybody in Israel. He could have. This issue of grace-based means he's going to make a decision as to how he's going to deal with this. And if he chooses to deal with it by grace, that's great. And if he chooses not to, then hardness is going to be the condition, and it's going to run its course. And that, of course, is what Paul is arguing in verse 7, that Israel's hardening had resulted in their seeking to establish themselves in righteousness by themselves. In other words, they were going to make themselves self-righteous, which would result in pride and all kinds of other destructive things. And that proved their hardness. And for the vast majority of Israel, God did not interfere. There were many Pharisees. And Saul of Tarsus was the only one that God stopped on the road to Damascus with the Shekinah glory and persuaded him to change his mind about a lot of stuff. That's an inevitable consequence of the grace issue, because it is uncompelled and it doesn't have to do with merit or demerit. God decides, this hardened person is going to die unless I do something, so I'm going to do something. And that's a gracious thing. So, even in the degree of interference, there is evidence in the scripture that that's determined by God too. Because Jesus himself taught that there would be some who would bear 30-fold and some 60-fold and some 100-fold. There were some people who were saved as young people, like Timothy, and there were other people who were saved in the nick of time, like the thief on the cross. Well, who decided to do all that? Who's the one who's making those decisions? Well, it's got to be, if it's grace, it's got to be God. Otherwise, you're cast back onto the issues of something in man that demands that God act. And if that's the case, then you're back into law, justice, and inevitable destruction. So, what we're going to do this evening is, having looked at all of those issues, we're going to look at David and what he is saying as a continuum. And what we're going to do is we're going to look at his statement, let their table become a snare and a trap and a stumbling block and a retribution to them. Let their eyes be darkened to see not and bend their backs until the end of time or through all time. The issue of the quote in verse 9, let their table become a snare and a trap and a stumbling block and a retribution to them. That in Greek, those phrases are exactly alike. It's unto this, unto this, unto this, unto this. And Psalm 69 is where you find this. And according to the footnotes in the Ryrie Study Bible, Ryrie says that Psalm 69 is one of the most quoted psalms in the New Testament. And it's indisputably, he didn't say this, but it's indisputably messianic, because 69:9a in Psalm 69, verse 9a, is quoted in regard to Jesus at Calvary. 69:21 is another one of those quotes where something's happening, it's happening to Jesus. 69:26, by way of Isaiah 53:4, is a comment about how he was grieved by God. Jesus was grieved by God as he visited the consequences of human sin upon him. They're all quoted in reference to Jesus' identity and his work. So this is a messianic psalm written by David, but there are aspects of it that are Davidic and not messianic, because in the psalm, 69 verses 5 and 6, David appeals as a sinner for grace. You know my sins. You know how I've transgressed. And so we can conclude from Psalm 69, where David got these words in verse 9, and 10, we can conclude that sinners can appeal to God for a certain kind of grace, and that's the kind that delivers. You can ask God to deliver you, but those same sinners can also appeal to God to abstain from grace when it concerns a certain type of sinner. Because David, who says, you know my sin, so I appeal to you for grace for deliverance, turns right around and says, but don't give it to them. And so there is a certain kind of person that can ask for deliverance by grace, and there is a certain kind of person that is not going to get it, because the text says they're not going to get it. That's what verse 7 actually said. Israel was seeking for something, couldn't get it, because they were seeking for self-righteousness, and you're not ever going to obtain that in any legitimate sense. And then there are those who are the elect who, according to chapter 9, weren't even looking for it, and they got it. And the ones who didn't get it were the ones that were the hardened. So that's a category of sinner, the hardened one. And David, though he mimics some of the behavior of the wicked, especially in the adultery murder issue, he revealed that he wasn't one of the so-called hardened, because even though it took a year of massive grief internally, his bones hurt, and it, you know, he was in turmoil the whole year, he refused to acknowledge his sin to God. God, by grace, sent Nathan to confront him, and when he was confronted, he cratered in humility and acknowledged his sin and sought forgiveness and was given it by God. That was evidence that the hardness that affected David that produced the adultery and the murder wasn't determinative hardness. It was, in a sense, it was kind of an aberration from David's typical life, because according to the summary on David's whole life is that he pleased God in everything except the Bathsheba thing. So, there are two types of sinners. There are the hardened sinners who sin out of their hardness and then are repentant. And of course, Paul would say, well, that's evidence of their election. But then there are the sinners who are in their hardness, and when they're confronted, they just get harder. And that was the generation of the religious leaders in the first century, when Jesus produced all the evidence that was necessary to establish his identity, and they said, that's just from the devil. Their hardness was already settled. So, in David's words, there is this appeal in verses 9 and 10. But let's look at the graceless justice on God's part that David is actually calling for. He says, let their table become a snare and a trap and a stone block and a retribution. Well, what is a graceless justice? Well, that simply means that God is refusing to interfere with the ongoing process of hardening. That's just, but there's no grace there. If God refuses to interfere, then there is a graceless application of justice, and hardness is the consequence of justice being applied. And as the justice maintains its dominion over this hardened person, they become more and more sinful, because Paul said the strength of sin is the law. So under justice, people just get worse and worse. And that's what I mean by graceless justice. It's just God's refusal to stop it, his refusal to interfere. Some people are bothered by the fact that God didn't even bother himself to interfere with the temptation of Adam in the garden. And he didn't. In American judicial perversion, if you can do something and don't, then you're guilty. But that's human misunderstanding of true justice. God doesn't hold to that at all, because he could do all kinds of things to stop all kinds of wickedness, and he doesn't. And that's not blameworthy. So, David's definition of the type of hardness that is to be allowed to pursue its course is given in verse 9, in the allowance of hardness to pursue its course, by four intention clauses. He wants their table to become a snare. Well, that's the first intention clause, because ace plus the word snare means, with this goal in mind, that their table should become to them a snare. Well, that word snare is a word that is used when a fowler, a guy who hunts birds for a living to eat, sets a trap for a bird, and he camouflages it in such a way and baits it in such a way that the bird is oblivious to the snare because of the appeal of whatever it is that is drawing him into it. And then it catches him, and he can't fly away. He's caught. It's a snare. And that's the whole idea, is that he's ensnared by a subtle trap set by the fowler. Well, the issue is really not the snare itself. David isn't saying let their table become a snare so that they'll be all tangled up in the snare. He is saying let their table become a snare so that what will happen to them after they are snared, ensnared, is the same thing that happens to the bird that's ensnared. In other words, they're destroyed because they have been ensnared by this thing. And then he says the second intentional phrase is let their table become a trap. Well, that word is only used one time in the New Testament. It's right here. But there is a book. It's called the Greek-English Lexicon of the New Testament based on semantic domains, whatever that means. But the word is dealt with in that book, and it says that the sense of the trap is to be any kind of trap except those used for birds. In other words, snares are one kind of a trap, but the other kinds of traps are included in this word trap instead of snare. And so you have this idea of, you've all seen the pictures of the bent over tree with a rope on it and a coil at the bottom, and it's all camouflaged, and the person steps on it, and then the tree snaps up and grabs him by the leg and jerks him off his feet, and he's hanging upside down by the rope. Well, that's a trap. Well, so is digging a hole that's 8 feet deep and putting stakes, sharpened stakes in the bottom, and then covering it over with something that won't support much weight, and camouflaging that right on the path where whatever you're going to trap's going, and whatever it is steps on that, and it gives way, and he falls into this hole that's 8 feet deep. But when he hits the bottom, he's dead because all these sharpened spikes are down there, and they pierce him through his body. That's another trap. And there are an innumerable number of illustrations. You've all seen the bear trap where they have this steel thing that you can force it open, and it's got a trap or a trigger right in the center. And if anything steps on it, those steel jaws with serrated edges, and then there's no getting out of it. That's what they used for coyotes and rabbits and things like that, that you wanted to get to ensnare. But the point of the trap, again, is not being trapped. It's what happens after the prey has been trapped. If it's a coyote, that's a bullet in the head. If it's a rabbit, it's probably skinned and put on a spit somewhere and turned over the fire until it's good to eat. Whatever it is, the point is, David wants their table to be for them a trap like that. That will, it'll destroy them. And then the third one is, he wants their table to become a stumbling block. And that's the word that's used in the New Testament when it's talking about something that causes a person to trip over the stumbling block. He trips over the block that's there because he doesn't see it, and it causes him to fall down. He's stumbling. And, of course, the ideal picture of all this destructive kind of stuff is that you're tripping them into some kind of a trap or snare or whatever. The whole point there is that you're caught again. He wants their table to become this stumbling stone so that the person doesn't see what will happen to him because he doesn't see what's going to trip him. If he could see the thing that was going to trip him, then the disaster that followed would not occur. And it's not the tripping that's the point. It's the consequence of the disaster that follows after. And it can be a literal stone that you stumble over. Jesus talked about the stone of stumbling that was set in Zion, and the legalists stumbled over it because the stone was the provision of a Redeemer through grace. Completely a doctrinal stumbling block. And Jesus became that stone of stumbling for all those religious leaders because of his doctrine, his behavior, his actions violated their sense of what they understood was the way to satisfy God or please him. And then the fourth intention is at the end of verse 9, let their table be a recompense or a retribution. And this basically is simply a request for their table to impose on them what they deserve. The request is for the maintaining of justice so that grace does not interfere. Retribution is a legal concept. For their table to become a recompense or retribution to them means don't stick your grace in here. Let happen what's going to happen because they deserve it. And this was Jonah's attitude in going to Nineveh. He did not want God to stick his grace in there. Well, David here in this imprecatory psalm doesn't want it either. But there was a significant difference between David and Jonah in that God wanted Jonah to go to Nineveh because he wanted to stick some grace into the mix. Jonah didn't want him to, but God did. He said, there are 120,000 people who don't know their right hand from the left. Why shouldn't I have mercy on them? You're all upset because I've had mercy on them, and you're all upset because this worm ate your plant that was giving you some shade. He had a lesson for Jonah, but when David is writing this, he's talking about those people who are responsible for the crucifixion of Christ at Calvary. That's where the quotes go to. And he's talking about these hard-hearted, self-righteous, hardened religious leaders who have gone down there to where the cross is, and they've stuck out their lip and they've made all these mocking sounds and they spit on him, and they say, if you're the Christ, come down, save yourself. You can't save yourself. How are you going to save anybody else? And on and on and on. David said, let them have it. Don't give them any grace. Don't let any grace come in here. So basically, he's talking about not interfering. He doesn't want God to interfere, so the consequences of the evil they've done will be visited upon them. That's his request. But that raises the question of what's really going on here in terms of how this is to work. And that's in verse 10. Let their eyes be darkened so they can't see. If you can't see, you're extremely liable to fall into a snare or a trap or stumble over something. And if you get into the snare or the trap or you stumble over it, you're going to get what you got coming. That's the recompense. So in verse 10, we have the methodology. Let their eyes be darkened so they can't see. But then there is this even more formidable consequence that their backs be bent forever. And the idea there is another one of these rare terms, but it basically means to have their backs bent over double. And the picture is of somebody who is so heavily burdened that he can barely carry the burden that's bending him all the way down as he tries to bear up under the load that's on him. And David says, that's what I want to happen to him. I want him to be so loaded up with the consequences of their behavior that they can't even stand up. And I want this to go all through time. But the question is, why does David have this attitude toward them in what he is saying? And the secret to the whole thing is the verse 9 as it starts out. Let their table become all these things. So the question is, what kind of table business is this? Well, how is it that their table is going to be a snare, a trap, or a stumbling block, and a recompense? Well, that's an interesting question, and so I just looked up the use of the word table in the New Testament. And the majority of the time, the New Testament tables are the places where people sit down to eat. Before we get into the significance of that, just let me say this. The use of the word tables throughout the New Testament is always the use of a platform, a table, but it's what's being on the table that's critical. When people sit down to eat, their table has become the piece of equipment that holds what they really want. They want to eat. And that's what the table was for. And you have stories, for example, about Lazarus and the rich man. Rich man's at his table. And Lazarus is appealing for just crumbs that come off the table. And he dies and goes to Abraham's bosom. The rich man dies and goes to hell. You have the Syrophoenician woman come and say, deliver my daughter from this demon. And Jesus says, it's not right to give the bread of the children to the dogs. He was being pretty rough on her because she was a dog. But her response was, yeah, but even the dogs get to lick up the crumbs the kids drop. And Jesus said, for that answer, go your way. Your daughter's delivered. So the whole point there is that the table is a metaphor for something that's very important to the person at the table. And so that's the way it's used consistently throughout the New Testament. But there are specific examples of tables that hold great interest, and they're, I think, instructive. First of all, as I said, the majority of the tables refer to sitting down to eat. But when you sit down to eat at a table, that's for people who eat to live. There are people who live to eat, and their table will become a snare to them. Because living to eat is pointing the finger at gluttons, and gluttons typically create their own problems by their gluttony. And it's a pretty serious sin as far as the New Testament is concerned. But those who don't live to eat, they sit down to eat so they can live. There's a very critical point of view there that food is necessary for life. And that makes the issue of the food an interesting thing for evaluation or investigation, because Jesus in the wilderness was tempted to eat. He had no table. He had no bread. And yet Satan said, this is silly. You don't have to put up with this. You're the Son of God. You can turn those stones over there into bread. Why go hungry when you don't have to go hungry? What's the point? Well, Jesus said, man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. And that means that even when we sit down at the table to eat so our physical bodies can continue to function and live, when we sit down there, we need to understand that our life does not come from the food. It comes from the provider of the food, who is God. Our life is wrapped up in Him. And that's one reason, I believe, that Paul said that when you give thanks for food, you are sanctifying the food. It's sanctified by the Word of God and prayer. So when a person views food properly, he sees it as a provision by God for his physical life to be sustained. But it's always a provision from God. And therefore, he doesn't substitute the food for God. He doesn't say, I've got to have this or I'll die, and that'll be the ultimate disaster. He doesn't say that, because it's not. The ultimate disaster is not having the life of God provided for you. And then you go from that issue of the food, you have the other issue of the tables, where Jesus goes into the temple twice in his earthly ministry, and he takes the tables of the thieves in the temple and he dumps their money all over the floor. And I'm sure that just blew a cork in them, because my money's getting mingled up with his money. How are we going to ever get this all straightened out? And the money's rolling all over the... And Jesus is going through there just knocking the tables over and spilling all their money and cracking the whip over their heads or maybe on their backs. And the point there is that those tables were holding the money that these thieves considered the foundation for their life. It's an issue of understanding what money's function is. And the scriptures say point blankly that money is the anti-God. People who view money as the way to get everything you need in life have created an idolatrous system in which money is the God. And money does give the appearance of being able to satisfy the three basic issues of life. You can buy food with it, you can buy friends with it, and you can buy status with it. Now, the friends you buy with it, I mean, they'll be your friends as long as you're going to share with them. But in our world, money is the thing that's sought after so enthusiastically by materialists because it's the anti-God. And Jesus says a whole lot about people's attitude toward money. And so if the tables are holding the money and that's what's important to you, then it's probably going to be a snare and a trap and a recompense, a stumbling block. And then there is the tables that Paul refers to when you eat at the table of a demon and you eat at the table of the Lord. He's talking there about the table of the Lord holding the cup and the bread for the communion. And the table of demons is where the food is served that has been offered to the false gods and the idols, the temple of the idols. And you're eating at the table of demons, Paul says. Well, that's the issue of worship. And what he's saying there is that the critical issue of the table is who you're going to worship. And if you make the wrong choice, if you're not going to worship God, you're going to worship some demon, well, then it's a snare and a trap and a stumbling block, and you're going to get the recompense, do you? And then finally, there is the table in Hebrews 9 that holds the showbread. And that table holding the bread in the sanctuary of the tabernacle or the temple was a sanctified bread. It wasn't supposed to be eaten by anybody but the priests. Unless you were David and you went in and asked for some and the priest voluntarily gave it to you. But nonetheless, that showbread was a deliberate pictorial presentation of what Jesus said when he said, "I am the bread of life. If you don't eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have no life in yourself." He said that in John's gospel. And the whole point there is that the feeding of the 5,000, the feeding of the 4,000, the dissertation on being the bread of life, that's all contained in this issue of Jesus being the essence of life. Just as physical food is the energy base for the physical body to be able to continue to go on and function, Jesus is the energy base for life in relationship with God. So that He's more important than the food on the table, because when your body does die, in spite of all that you eat, or perhaps because of it, your death is not the end of you. But if you haven't eaten the bread of life, when you're dead, you're really dead, because you're going to go to the second death. And so David was actually asking, was that for people who had made their table decisions, they had decided what was the most important thing to them, and it was not God. It was not a relationship with God. It was some idolatrous something off the wall. Food, money, worship of demons, whatever. He said, people in this category who've made their table decision, let it be to them a recompense. Let come to them what they've got coming, because they've made their decision to pursue this in spite of everything else. And I'm sure that in some ways what Paul had in mind was the Jewish people of the first century, of which he was a part, and he saw how hardened the people had become, particularly in the Pharisaical section of those people, in terms of their decision to establish themselves as qualified for God's kingdom by their own performance, their self-righteousness. Paul said, they have made their decision. They have rejected God's Christ. They have rejected the righteousness of God. And they've done it all because they seek to establish themselves in righteousness before God. As if that was even that's irrational. Given Genesis 3, that's irrational. But nonetheless, they had settled that decision. If I can't go to heaven based on what I do, then I don't want to go. I've even heard country and western songs that had something to say about that. So the point is, what Paul and David are basically addressing in verses 9 and 10 is this condition called the hardened. And he's talking about a people for whom hardness has become an irrevocable decision. And it has to do with the decisions they've made about what's important to them. That's what the table is all about. And that life decision about what will produce life, and everybody makes that decision unto an irrevocable end at some point. Everybody decides what will bring them life. And once that decision is hardened, they are hardened. And it's this evidence of this process of hardening that's been going on. Jesus said about food, going to the table to eat, he said, don't worry about what you're going to eat or drink. Your Father knows you have need of that. Seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and you'll have that provided for you. He said, in terms of money, it's an anti-God. You are going to get caught up in the snares of all of the desires because of the money. And if you make that your idol, you're into covetousness and idolatry. And once that becomes a hardened commitment, it ends up being the worship of a hapless idol. It can't talk, can't speak, can't do anything for you. And you're so stupid, you think it can. Because You're praying to it, you're bowing down to it, you're kissing it, and it's a piece of wood or stone or... And then, in terms of worship, it's not bread, money, or demons that can give you life. You ought to worship the one who can give you life. And then, finally, in Jesus' identity as the fulfillment of the showbread metaphor, if you don't eat his flesh and drink his blood, you're not going to get life. And so, David's request is, for people who are in this state, and that's what Psalm 69 is about. It's about people who are treating God's Christ the way they're treating him. He says, let their hardness continue. Don't interrupt it with grace until it gets to its final end. That's David's desire. Fortunately for Paul, God didn't listen. But the conclusion that we draw, the thing we draw as a conclusion is that hardness exists and will be allowed to develop except by God's choice to interfere by grace so that some, that he calls the elect, obtain life and the rest don't because they're the hardened. So that's what's going on in this support. Paul actually says that verses 8, 9, and 10 are to support the conclusion that we're to draw from the statement in verse 6, it's by grace, and it's not on the basis of works, or grace isn't grace. So what should we conclude? Well, we should conclude this. God's operating on the basis of grace for the sake of some, and for a great number of others. He is not going to interfere with justice becoming the standard by which they are treated.